This week on Retronauts, Enoch with the blue jeans, blue jeans, blue jeans, Enoch with the blue jeans on, ooh, yeah, Enoch with the blue jeans, blue jeans, blue jeans, Enoch with the blue jeans on. I snapped my fingers. Didn't work. Hello. Welcome back to Retronauts. Welcome to this very special, divinely inspired Retronauts, as we're here to talk about the one, the only El Shaddai, Ascension of the Metatron, a video game unique unto itself, even though there are sequels and spinoffs and a lot to talk about. But first, I'm your host, Diamond Fight, not wearing blue jeans. Sorry, it's too early for blue jeans. And joining me around the world, so many guests today. Let's start with returning guest and Batman expert.
Oh, that's me. Yes. Hi, everybody. It's Chris Sims, noted Batman expert and a biblical extra-canonical dabbler.
Good enough. And
the Elijah to my partner's Enoch.
Okay. And your partner being...
Hey, it's me, Benito Serino. I'm a writer and a podcaster, and together with Chris, sometimes we do a podcast called ApocryPals, which is about Bible and tangentially related Bible things, including this game, for example.
Yes, I know you covered the same ones on your own podcast. Thank you for joining us for this podcast. And also joining us for this podcast, a man intimately associated with this game and Retronauts in general, because he's been here many times.
Shane Bettenhausen, and I'm not wearing my Lucifel jeans. I considered it, but it's a little humid here today, and I imagine it's even more hot and humid in Kyoto, where you are, Diamond, so...
Osaka, but yes, it's already warm.
Oh, Osaka, but yeah, they were very tight jeans. I don't know if any of you own those El Shaddai jeans. They were very form-fitting.
Yeah.
And yet you can do so many combos in them.
Well, and I'm so happy you have them on, because, like, the whole actual Book of Enoch, apocryphal religious aspects of El Shaddai, are the most baffling to me, so I'm so happy you have real experts...
Don't worry, they're very straightforward. They make a lot of sense. They're super linear.
Yep, no problem at all.
But yes, I did work at Ignition when this game during the development of this game and up to its release, and I have very fond memories of it. And I'm happy that it's now considered old enough to be on Retronauts. So
yeah, I know that people often respond to the social medias, and they're like, "Oh, that game's not retro," and I just can't believe it's been 14,000 years.
Well, the last 10 years feel like 14,000 years in America.
That's true, actually.
It could have been 360,000 years. Or maybe yesterday?
Or maybe a snap of your fingers.
Or tomorrow.
What a fun time. It's fun to revisit this. It does feel a long time ago now. So, yeah, I'm happy we're doing this. And, and this game is a little bit of a mystery. And I have a few pieces of intel that might shed a little light on it. But, looking back, it's really interesting and unique, and I'm glad it's still accessible and people can play it in 2026.
So did you worked on this game?
I was the business development manager. It was already in development by the time I got to Ignition, but it was about a year and a half before it came out, maybe a year before it came out, about a year before it came out. And I got to work with the team and see it come, see the final stretch of development for it. I spent a lot of time with, Sawaki and Kimura and those guys, so...
I have an important question, then. How much is it going to hurt your feelings when Chris clowns on this game?
Yeah.
It's not about the gameplay. It's more about the aesthetic of the game.
Okay.
If you're going to hate on the aesthetic, then we might come to blows.
We'll see what happens.
Anything could happen.
In direct human years, this game came out in 2011, and we're recording this in 2026, so in direct human years, this game is 15 years old, and it is certainly retro. It was, at the time, exclusive to PlayStation 3 and Xbox 360. It has since been rescued from that, from those platforms. It's now available on multiple platforms in HD remaster, but we'll talk about that stuff later. Let's start with the background, the basics, ground zero, if you will. This is a game that is based on something called the Book of Enoch, so I think we really do need to establish what is a Book of Enoch.
Well, and I would say the average Christian doesn't really know what that is. Like, as a kid who grew up in the Christian church, never talked about.
Yeah, so there is the Book of Enoch, but strictly speaking, there's a broader category of Enochic literature, right? So this game is actually pulling from three different books, which are 1st, 2nd, 3rd Enoch, which are not direct sequels to each other. They're different traditions from different times in history, right? And each one is kind of cobbled together from different things in history. The best known Book of Enoch is 1st Enoch, and if you hear someone say Book of Enoch, that's the one they mean. That is a text that would have originally been five different texts that were then redacted or edited together. It existed. It would have been put together sometime during the Second Temple period, meaning the time after the Babylonian exile for the people of Judah, who were after they were conquered by Babylon, after they were allowed by Cyrus and the Persians to come back and rebuild Jerusalem and rebuild their temple. So we're talking about 5th, 6th century BCE. So starting in that time period and then getting up to 1st century BCE, CE, the flip over part because of Jesus. during that,
I realized that you weren't just like taking an aside about how complicated this is, that you were actually saying it is because of Jesus of Nazareth.
Yeah, right. Yes, because of Jesus, that's why the time is different. why we started counting backwards.
People are probably familiar with that one.
Maybe. But the Book of Enoch would have been known to the authors of the Bible, and in fact, the Book of Jude specifically in the Bible quotes it, references it, but it was largely lost. We know it was important to the community at Qumran, the Dead Sea Scrolls people, because we have fragments of it among the Dead Sea Scrolls. But that also means they probably didn't, the version they had was probably not the same as the one that survives to this day. The one that we have only survives in full in the language, a language called Ge'ez, which is an Ethiopian language. It's got a very cool looking alphabet. If you look at it, it's a language that kind of survives only as a kind of sacred or church language, basically, in Ethiopia. And that's where the book is held in the most reverence. It is part of the Ethiopian Orthodox Tewahedo Church. It also has some currency among the Beta Israel, who are Ethiopian Jews.
Yes.
And so that's the one that if people know it, that's the one they're thinking of. But there's also the second Book of Enoch, which is also called the Slavonic Book of Enoch, because it survives in Old Church Slavonic. But it would have originally, the first one was probably originally in Hebrew or Aramaic or a combination thereof. The second one was either Hebrew, Aramaic, or Greek, but survives only in Slavonic. And then the third one is called the Hebrew Enoch because it survives fully in Hebrew. But, they, 1st, 2nd, 3rd, they progress throughout time, although especially by the time of the third Book of Enoch, the window for when it could be from is basically 1,000 years. Some people will argue.
Or maybe yes, tomorrow.
Maybe tomorrow. Some people say like this could have predated Christianity. Maybe it influenced Paul's understanding of cosmology. But some people were like, no, this goes even into the Middle Ages. And again, it's assembled from different parts. And so the answer could be both, right? Parts of it existed, but it was the final form, the redacted form that we have didn't happen until Babylonian Jews in the 5th, 6th century CE put it together.
This game is inspired by like one part of like the Book of Watchers, right? Of like one, the book Enoch one, right?
So the Book of Watchers, like I said, the first Book of Enoch is made up of five different books, and the Book of Watchers is the most famous part and the most influential part. The Watchers in this case refer to the Grigori, or the Grigori as they're called in the game. The Watchers in the sense of being awake, not necessarily in the sense of like looking over or looking at something. If you could call them the woke, I guess, if you want.
They're above the angels, the Grigori, right?
In the Book of Watchers, the idea is that these are essentially the fallen angels, and the names of the angels used in the game pretty much all come from the Enochic literature. Semyaza is their leader, and then you have other ones. I'm definitely
Azazel.
Yeah, Azazel.
Samiel.
Sariel's in the game.
Ezekiel. There's like 20 in the book, and there's 7, I think, in the game.
Yes.
Lucifel is not in the book. But the idea is, let me start with who is Enoch, right?
I wanted to ask that because we call this thing the Book of Enoch, and we're just kind of assuming that Enoch wrote this, because obviously we don't know who wrote this, and it may not be one person.
He definitely did not. For a couple of reasons.
I had heard of Enoch before I came to El Shaddai as like a type of Christ, like in college or something, like as like a prefigure of Christ, right? Yeah.
I feel like it's important for lay people who aren't necessarily steeped in weird apocryphal texts like we are. The part of the Book of Enoch you have heard of is anytime you've seen something referred to online as biblically accurate, that's actually not from Bible. That's from the Book of Enoch, which is not in the Bible.
Unless you're Ethiopian church.
Yeah.
Shout out Ethiopia. But
All the angels with all the eyes. That's what people mostly know.
Yeah. So Enoch is a real guy in the Bible. Probably not a real guy in real life. Sorry. Probably not. But he's part of the primeval history that is the first 11 chapters of Genesis, which is another book that, like Enoch, is assembled together from disparate traditions. And we're not getting into that. Listen to our podcast, Apocrypals, to hear us talk about documentary hypothesis and that kind of stuff. But he is the father of Methuselah, who I think most people know as the oldest guy in the Bible. And then he's the great-grandfather of Noah from the flood. Although at the time the part about Enoch was written, Noah probably wasn't the flood guy. He was probably just the guy who invented wine.
Are you implying the Bible is a retcon?
The Bible is extremely retconned.
Apocrypals, available on many podcast services.
Podcasts related.
We're like, somehow the Emperor returned the Bible.
Yeah. So, yeah, in the earliest layers of the story, Noah would have just been the guy who invented wine, and then the flood narrative is added later.
Wow.
And so where we see Enoch is in Genesis chapter 5, let's see, verse 21. When Enoch had lived 65 years, he became the father of Methuselah. Enoch walked with God after the birth of Methuselah 300 years and had other sons and daughters. Thus, all the days of Enoch were 365 years. Enoch walked with God, then he was no more because God took him. And that's it. So what happens is people extrapolate on that because, you know, there's something tantalizing, titillating about the idea of like this guy was no more because God took him.
God took him means he died. Galaxy brain. God took him and gave him genes.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, he also walked with God. That's interesting verbiage. Oh, walk with God.
Yeah. And so what Enochic literature does is interprets that idea as Enoch is taken bodily into heaven, which I will note that at this time was not a place where people went when they died, but it was the literal sky where there were big garages full of snow and God lived there and the stars skated around and there were big train tracks that the sun and stuff moved on.
I want to play that game. That game sounds good.
Yeah, well, so that stuff
I mean,
is in
yeah.
the... Yeah.
Diamond, get Nomura on the phone.
Yeah. Heaven was very much seen and understood as a physical place that you could go if you went up high enough. It was a series of domes, essentially crystalline domes. And
pleasure domes.
So the Enochic literature falls under the broader spectrum of apocalyptic literature, which is very popular in the Second Temple period, that period between like 500 BCE until about 70 CE. Around New Testament times, right? So this all of this stuff would be heavily influential on the authors of the New Testament, right? And so apocalyptic literature, and arguably Christianity as a whole, is just an apocalyptic offshoot of Judaism, right? Because when we talk about apocalyptic literature, we hear the word apocalypse and we think end of the world, but really what it means is revelatory literature. Apocalypse and revelation are literally mean the same thing. It's just that one's Greek and one's Latin. They both mean an unveiling. And so the idea is this is cosmic information being revealed to a human who then writes it down.
I'm so glad you brought that up, because I think I have a theory. One reason that Japanese video games in particular love to have revelations as a subtitle is because they are drawing upon the translation, which is basically the same as apocalypse. So I think it sounds, when it's translated back into Japanese, I think it sounds a lot more significant and important. Whereas to an English-speaking audience, I'm like, okay, what is being revealed about this? When I play Resident Evil Revelations, what exactly is being revealed to me? And it's really not that much, other than that there's a terrorist organization named after a greyhound, apparently.
Is there a game called Apocalypse : Revelations?
Oh, God. There should be.
It's got to be like a third-person shooter from the Xbox 360 era, right?
There was an Apocalypse, and there was a Revelations, but not an Apocalypse Revelations.
Mm.
Man, wow. Something to think about. So anyway, within apocalyptic literature, the thing we're looking at is, it's basically if cope was a literature, what if we called it a copalyptic literature? Because the idea is we, Israel and Judah, poor us, have been conquered so many times by everyone, including currently either the Hellenistic Empire or the Romans, whichever time period within the Second Temple period we're looking at. But we're supposed to be the chosen people of a loving and all-powerful God. How do we account for this? And so you have someone who receives a divine revelation that explains, well, here's actually how the world and the universe works, including here's how God's justice is going to play out. And that's why we end up with so many that have to do with the end of the world, because it's revealing the ways in which God's people will be rewarded and the enemies of God's people will be cast into the lake of fire or whatever, right?
Oh, that makes so much sense to me. Yeah.
Yeah. And so the Book of Enoch very much falls within that, at least portions of it. Portions of it have Enoch being toured around creation. And so he explains, here's what the different levels of heaven are like. He goes down into Sheol, which is the underworld before the concept of hell developed, which was kind of a thing for Christianity. Like the reason heaven and hell become an afterlife for actual like human souls go to them is because originally it wasn't that. We were waiting for either the Messiah, whether he's Jesus or not, to come to usher in a messianic age where we live on an earthly paradise. But the thing is, we kept waiting and that kept not happening. And so they were like, well, nobody's getting punished or rewarded in the meantime. And so they go, well, what if we went to the sky or a big fire instead? and that kind of got introduced, which was not originally the idea. The idea was everyone dead goes into a big pit, and then later they're going to be bodily resurrected and either go live in the Garden of Eden or get eaten by a big monster or something. Right. And so Enoch looks at all that. It explains how the weather works. It explains how the stars and the constellations work. Then it does a long bit where it explains all of history, but everyone is in their fursona. That part's called the animal apocalypse. That's real. I'm not making that up.
I believe you.
Yeah. And it's that kind of stuff. There's a little epilogue that's all about how Noah was born and how he was a special baby that was so bright that anyone who looked at him would be blinded. And he looked, basically Noah looked like he was a literal little angel baby. Oh. And he's like immediately after birth, he like stands up and starts saying like, Mom, the world will be destroyed in a flood.
I knew that early.
He knew they
didn't get around to building that boat for so long.
Terrible twos. Am I right?
The main plot of the Book of the Watchers is that the angels, they get really horny for human women. And so they come down and then they interbreed and they make with
the
humans.
The Nephilim, right? Yeah.
And that's where the Nephilim come from, which in the Book of Enoch are giants, and they're terrible and they're ruining the world. They're eating up all the resources and they start eating the people. They're warring amongst themselves. And so that's why God decides that he's going to flood the world, was not because human sin was so great, but because humans had a lot of sex with angels and made giants that were destroying everything. And in fact, the reference in Jude is really him saying, don't have sex with angels. Because right. he's referring, when he talks about this. So a lot of people use this quote in Jude.
But what if they have, like, you know how some people have beautiful eyes?
Yeah.
Imagine that they had 6,000 of them and every time one blinked, someone died.
That's yeah. Yeah.
I mean,
who could resist?
Like in the game El Shaddai, Angel Sario, who is David Bowie, who wouldn't have sex with that angel? Come on. Like,
right. I mean, look, the Book of Enoch, or the El Shaddai, the Ascension of the Metatron, does in fact posit a world full of sexy boy angels.
Yeah, yes. Who are all dressed like the cast of a CW drama.
And like the idea of Nephilim are just giant people, not giant phalluses like in El Shaddai, Ascension of the Metatron.
Yeah.
It's weird that God needed to do a flood instead of just inventing the square cube law, which really would have taken those giants right out.
And also, like, the belief in Nephilim, like, you know, they for a long time, you know, in history, like, people would find proof of giants, and sometimes they would, like, link that to, oh, this is proof that Nephilim existed, like, you know, like,
yeah,
as an idea.
But, yeah, the fallen angels also are the, in this account of things, are the what introduced sin to humanity. It's the angels who bring forbidden knowledge of how to craft weapons and armor and how to, and also make makeup is one of them, because that's supposed to, you know, that leads to sinful thoughts and things.
Sin.
Yeah. And so the different sins are skills and trades introduced to humans by the fallen angels. And so then, yeah, long as you go on in the text, the good angels, primarily the archangels, Michael, Gabriel, Raphael, Uriel, they're dispatched to basically imprison the fallen angels. And then, yeah, you get all the other stuff. And that more or less, that's the first one. The second one, second Enoch adds an important element, which is not only does Enoch remain in heaven, he's actually cleansed with divine fire so that he becomes something more than human. And in both, he essentially becomes the divine scribe, which is how he's portrayed at the beginning of the game.
Yes.
His job is to record all of existent history. And that's why in the game he's got the mountains of books behind him. But I assume that's why. But yeah, it's in the second Book of Enoch where where they're like, he becomes something more than human. And by the time of third Enoch, they specifically and explicitly call him out as having become the Metatron, which is the highest of the angels. And in fact, he is basically called Yahweh Jr. Oh. And he has a little desk next to God's desk.
Bowser Jr. Yeah.
And so
the little desk is what got me. The little desk is like one of the funniest things I've ever heard.
Yeah. If the listeners are interested in like angels and demons, Third Enoch is probably the most complex angelology from antiquity. And so you'll see lists of all the different kinds of angels and how many there are and the adjectives that apply to them and their jobs and what they do. But, you know, for the sake of this discussion we're having here, you know, the main thing is that this is the point at which Enoch becomes a being full of fire and lightning who has, 360,000 eyes, and his eyelashes are made of lightning and that kind of stuff. It's all really explicitly explained. And yeah, he has a second little throne next to God's big throne. And he essentially, he's a type for Christ. And if people don't know type, you know, in this case means like a prototype for Christ. And so he becomes associated. Enoch and the Metatron kind of get conflated with elements of Michael, the archangel, and then the angel of the Lord. And essentially it gets to the point where Metatron is so popular that you have rabbinic literature where people are having to make Metatron look bad because there were people who were like, yeah, no problem. There's two gods. There's God and God Jr. No problem. And, you know, meanwhile, of course, you have Christians who are like, yeah, God and God Jr. That totally makes sense. But their God Jr. is named Jesus and not Metatron. But otherwise, it's basically the same thing. Because if you look at how Paul understood Jesus, he would have been a human man who was taken up into heaven and purified during following his crucifixion. He's purified up in heaven and becomes divine. That's how in Paul's epistles, Jesus is described. And so in that sense, he's very much following the pattern established by Enoch. And then some other characters that, figures that we see throughout, Second Temple literature that represent kind of, the authorized bearer of, God's power and that kind of stuff. So that's what the Metatron is. Nobody really knows what the name means. It might come from, it might be a Greek name that means, it might be from Metatronon, which would mean like, next to the throne, because that's where he sits. He sits next to the throne.
Wow.
But nobody really knows what it means. But anyway, you know, if people are interested in hearing me and Chris talk about this for literally hours and hours, we cover all of the Enochic literature on our podcast, Apocryphals, in episodes 39, which is called Rain is Boy Water, episode 40, called Devil Got a Hog, episode 61, Countless Large Gregs, episode 86, God Jr., episode 87, Crisis on 18,000 Earths, and episode 105, which is called Approximate Week 5 Ravager. That's the one where we talk about this game. But if you want to hear literally like 6, 7, 8 hours of me and Chris talking about this weird stuff, yeah, 6, 7, yeah. I would recommend checking out our episodes.
Wow, that's an amazing rabbit hole that I did not expect to be able to go down. I may have to do that.
Wow. Yeah. One more Bible fact. The title, El Shaddai, Ascension of Metatron. As I believe I said on our episode, there's two things wrong with that title, which is the part before the colon and the part after the colon. So El Shaddai, right, is another name for the God of Israel, although it probably was originally a discrete Semitic or Canaanite deity, but it later becomes conflated with Yahweh, the big Bible God, and applied to him. And it's generally often translated as God Almighty. Nobody knows exactly what it means. My preferred theory is that it means the boob God.
No explanation needed.
Yeah, no explanation. No, the idea is that there's a mountain on each edge of the earth, and so he's the God who encompasses everything from one mountain to the other. He's truly the God of the cleavage, which is the earth.
Okay.
So El Shaddai, the boob God. And the other problem is that he doesn't become Metatron. He does ascend. It is a platformer, so he does go up a lot. So ascension is fine, but it could have been called Enoch, Ascension of Enoch, I think is probably – what I would have personally said.
Enoch, Ascension of Enoch, : Revelation, : Apocalypse. Colon,
Apocalypse, yeah.
My suggested title for it was Boyonetta. Which I don't know if that was gonna catch on.
I believe the original working title was Angelic, I believe,
Chris, do you remember what your suggested title was for it on a podcast?
I don't want to say it because it's mean.
Oh, really? You sure?
It's mean, and I don't want to. I don't want to be mean.
Okay, so I definitely
we're on video, and I'm getting looked at right now. So no, I don't want to say it.
Okay, well, it wasn't Chris, but somebody might have called it Baya Not a Good Game.
It's a good pun.
Okay. Now, you mentioned Jesus, and Jesus is sir not appearing in this game, but we do have a guy hanging out most of the time called Lucifel. Now, I should stress, so far, listeners, you've heard many voices here, and all three of our guests are some flavor of Christian. I myself am Jewish. I have seen all five of the Prophecy movies that originally starred Christopher Walken, but eventually he stopped showing up. So that's about the limit of my knowledge of angels and such. So when I see when I hear the name Lucifel, is that Lucifer? Are they related? What's happening there? Does anyone know the story behind that?
Well, my thought on that, I mean, it's clearly meant to evoke Lucifer, right? Which the origins of Satan and the devil is that's a whole other, that could be a very long podcast, but
right.
I think changing the name here from Lucifer to Lucifel is just to make it adhere to the naming convention of most angels, which is ending what we call a theophoric name bearing an element of God. So the L, so just like Michael, Mikhail, Gabriel, right, Raphael. Right. So now we have Lucifel, but I think we're supposed to understand it as like, this is the pre-fallen Lucifer when he's still just an angel, even though he's just a hunky boy with a cell phone talking to the divine council.
Diamond, I would also, to your earlier statement, I would say I was raised Christian. I would not necessarily classify myself as a Christian anymore. But and in terms of Lucifer, I think you're completely right that the naming convention was in order to like align with all the other angels, and that in Japanese, there's no differentiation between L and R sounds. And this was an original creation from Sawaki, the game's director, I think this character was kind of created as a new addition in order to like kind of insert himself into the game a bit. I think it's like his kind of avatar.
In he a way. Does. They much, do resemble each other, don't
yeah,
they?
Yeah, he's a much more modern character with the 100 yen umbrella and the cell phone, and like he's kind of an interloper in the Book of Enoch.
We mentioned on the show like the whole premise of Apocrypha House is that Benito and I classify ourselves as non-believers, both of us raised in the church as adults, not practicing or believing.
And Christian mythology is so interesting, and like it is, the deeper you get, and that's part of what brought me to this game. It's like the Evangelion was already a thing I liked. I was like, oh wait, this is even more insane than Evangelion. Oh, should I?
Yeah. So we tend to on Apocrypha House. One of the I actually had to describe the show to my dentist the other day because she was asking about what I do, and I was like, yeah, we are two comics writers who say that we take the Bible exactly as seriously as we take Superman, but you have to understand that we take Superman very seriously.
Yeah, and our other refrain is if you can understand X-Men, you can understand the Bible.
Which no one can.
Yeah.
Right. Well, and again, like part of what drew me to El Shaddai to go work at this company was that it was like this thing based on Christian Apocrypha reflected through the lens of this Japanese development team. And then once I got into the company and the deeper I got in development, I realized actually behind the whole thing, the actual mastermind behind this game is someone who was raised Hindu, which made it even more interesting to me. That like the person pulling the strings, like the CEO of Ignition, was an Indian guy who was raised Hindu, and this was like really, he was the one who like put the first spark of idea in, like brought together the team to make this game happen. Which like kind of like four dimensional chess. I was like, what does that even mean? Right, very interesting. Like this cross cultural religious insanity.
Well, on that note, then let's start talk about the people who actually made the game. As you mentioned, this game was developed and published by Ignition. The development studio was Ignition Tokyo. The larger company was Ignition Entertainment, which existed for quite a while, but then sort of went away all of a sudden.
Well, so Ignition Entertainment, I give a little context. It was fully owned by UTV, which was at the time the number one Bollywood film studio and television broadcasting network in India, which by the time Ignition went out of business, it was later purchased and became Disney India.
Oh.
And the CEO of Ignition and his brother were kind of given carte blanche to like form a game studio, and the idea of making three original IPs, one in the US, one in UK, and one in Japan, and also like pick up and publish other games.
Are you telling me that El Shaddai Enoch, El Shaddai Simpson of the Metatron's own Enoch, could be in Kingdom Hearts?
Yes. No, so actually, shockingly, Disney sold the rights to El Shaddai back to Sawaki. So that's why there's tons of cell phone games and manga to this day. So he actually got the rights back. So no, he couldn't. Sadly, Enoch cannot be a Disney princess. Like, no.
But there was a window where he could have been.
There was a window where he could have been. So yeah, the core staff was like ex-Capcom, ex-Clover, which you can get at your Diamond, yeah.
Yes, so the main figure at the top of this pyramid here is Sawaki Takayasu. He is credited as director and character designer, and his first credit in games is all the way back at Devil May Cry 2001. He was credited as an artwork, but then he has many credits on Clover Studios and Platinum Games titles. And much more recently, like within the last few months, he was recently announced as the new head of Ponkle Japan. Ponkle being the Vampire Survivors people. They're opening a new studio here in Japan. So that's a big gig for him. Yeah.
That's very cool, yeah.
Producer of the game is Masato Kimura. He also joined Capcom back in 1999. He also worked on many Clover titles. Like Takayasu, he worked on Devil May Cry and those sort of games. And I also want to highlight Kasho Oda, who's credited as head of production, and his credits go way back to the 90s, and he's often credited in stuff like motion design and face modeling, so he must have been working a lot in the sort of graphics department and probably working with actors and motion capture people for Sega and Capcom. So he has a lot of credits in those departments, running right through up the 90s and early aughts, right up until this game sort of came to existence.
Yeah, there's a lot of the same, like, Capcom Devil May Cry DNA that splits off into Platinum in this game. Like, that, hence Bayonetta.
Yeah, in fact, I'm surprised they didn't go with Angel May Cry. Maybe they felt that was too close.
Well, and DMC was definitely, like, a launching point, but I think part of the concept was to make it a more user-friendly, simpler, like, stripped down, simple, not as complicated, no inventory. And the idea that it would be more accessible, but still keep it challenging, which is a tough thing to do. I know that Sawaki's idea was really like, it's more about the visuals and the experience and a little bit less about the scope of the game. It was from the beginning actually kind of scoped out to be kind of a small to mid scope game. It was never meant to be this like colossal, like, 20 level thing also. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So let's get into the cast of characters who are largely drawn from the sources we talked about earlier. So the hero of the game, the protagonist, is a man named Enoch, and the video game version is voiced by Shinichiro Miki in Japanese, or Blake Ritson in English. So Shinichiro Miki, you might know him as the longtime voice of Akira in Virtua Fighter, or he voices Charizard in many forms. So he's out there shouting Pokemon names in the microphone. Good for him.
Wow.
That's a good gig if you can get it. Blake Ritson is British, and the only credit I could find that of some note to me was he played Griggs of Vinheim in Dark Souls.
I think all the voices were recorded in London, I think.
That would make sense, because
For the English dub, yeah. And the Lucifer is like a big, Jason Isaacs.
Yes, right? Lucifer, yeah. The English voice, is Jason Isaacs, who's frankly an actor. I think he's only more famous today. I think he's probably grown in stature since then. He's, I think of him personally as the ornery doctor from Event Horizon, but
talking about the Mirror Universe's own Jason Isaacs?
Yeah, yes, Star Trek Discovery is Jason Isaacs. Yeah.
The guy who showed Whole Hog on The White Lotus?
I'll take your word for that. I have not seen that program, but yes, that Jason Isaacs. A Japanese was Ryota Takeuchi.
All the jokes you couldn't make on Apocryphals are coming out now.
That's right. Okay. That's right.
Also, fine.
Because White Lotus season 3 had not been filmed yet when we did our episode 2 years ago.
True.
And basically, Enoch and Lucifer are a team in that Enoch is running around the world and doing all this stuff, and periodically he runs into Lucifer, who is talking on a cell phone, presumably to God, the God, up in heaven somewhere. And this game takes place over an inconceivable amount of time. They suggest that 100 years have passed since the game starts in, like, the midpoint of the game. And at one point, Enoch takes a nap, and I think it's, like, 10 years long. But time is very funny here. That's why we made so many jokes about what if it's today, what is it tomorrow. Because Lucifer seems to exist outside of this timeline, because Lucifer, in particular, is wearing very modern clothes. He has a cell phone. Not a smartphone. Not that futuristic, but he has a cell phone.
Feature phone.
Yeah. And he's got a plastic umbrella, and he sees, so we don't really know what time means to these people. They're not really people, I guess, but these characters, we don't know what time means to them, but we know as a character, we are journeying forward with Enoch on his quest, but then you got Lucifer out here who seemingly exists outside of that entirely.
I will say, like, you know, as much as I love this game, it has issues. And one of the issues, I think, is that Enoch does feel, like, out of, like you know, like, the fact that disconnect between Lucifer's amount of knowledge and your amount of knowledge as Enoch, the protagonist, it does make you feel, like, a little bit of, like, a simpleton. And, like you don't really know what's going on. You're just a pawn, like, the whole time in the game because of Lucifer.
Yeah, there's not a lot of explanation, and there's not a lot of coherence to what you're doing.
No, it's very abstract. Like, it's very abstract.
Yeah, I feel like that's a barrier. It is. This is a game that made me say a phrase that does not get used often in the English language, which is that I really wish this third-person spectacle fighter action game was more biblically accurate.
See, I think part of the appeal of El Shaddai is the impressionistic, like, you know, like kind of like vagueness of it all, but that doesn't mean it holds together as cohesive. But it is very, like, ambitious in its abstraction.
Yeah, I would agree. I think there's a lot of that works for it and against it, in that, like, the plot and the locations are very abstract and stylized and visually
they're memorable. Like,
yeah,
like,
memorable.
We can all remember what the first level looks like, because it's very weird. It's very you know, strange aesthetic, but, like, does it really convey what's happening exactly? Not so
right.
much.
They're very disjointed in a way that makes them kind of inherently interesting, but it makes it hard for you to be like, where am I and what am I doing?
Yeah, you're not left with much to hang on to, but, like, the ride was weird and trippy and interesting. Yeah. But, like, if you're trying to actually make sense of the Book of Enoch, it's abstract.
So the Nephilim are here, but yes, they are not giants or really particularly humanoid at all in this game. They're, in fact, adorable abominations. They're very rounded and cute looking. However, Lucifer tells us that the Nephilim are indeed very problematic because they're eating each other. And as they eat each other, they grow stronger and more angrier. At one point, they eat one of the angels and becomes a boss. So the Nephilim are trouble to the world, but when you see them in the game, they're super cute and really don't interfere with you in any way. And if anything, they help you.
Anyone who's listening who is familiar with Moomin, the Nephilim look exactly like the Hatifatteners from Moomin. They look like tall white hot dogs with hands.
See, I think they're more phallic than you're letting on. I think they're phallic on purpose. I got to say. I worked on this game. I have a plush Nephilim, and I think they're phallic on purpose. I think it's part of the whole Bishonen, like, the secret is, like, part of the appeal of El Shaddai in Japan was, like, this, like, very, like, Bishonen appeal. If you want to explain that, Diamond, more, like,
Bishonen is a Japanese term for basically a beautiful boy. So, like, Shonen is basically collection, you know, boy, and B is just, it's just pretty. So you got Bishonen, right, and you got Bishoujo,
and then BL is, like, the next level from that, which is, like, you like a lot of fandom, like, boy love, like. Like, yeah, like, having really sexy male characters and, like, masculine energy. And, like, I think the Nephilim is, like, kind of partially a joke on that in a way. The way they look.
Somehow way more sexually charged to be walking around in jeans and no shirt than like Kratos. You know, like well, technically armor, more clothes.
Like Enoch, like his armor like bursts off of him. He has like a Sailor Moon style like clothes flying off his body moment in the game while you're playing.
But just those tight jeans.
The jeans.
No, they're really tight. They're half lycra. I own a pair. They're very, very form-fitting.
Wow. I remember we talked at length about the jeans when we discussed this on our podcast. But I actually I looked up on eBay to see if there were any available for sale, and there were none.
Well, they reproduced them right after COVID, they reproduced the jeans for the 10th anniversary of El Shaddai.
Wow.
Yeah, my pair is getting a little threadbare, and I only have the Lucifer ones. I don't have the Enoch ones, so I actually considered buying them, but they sold out really fast.
This leads me into a question that I wanted to ask, because I didn't ask this on Apocrypals, and I think it'll be more interesting now that there's all four of us. What religious figure do you think would be funniest to have a pair of jeans, other than Enoch? I feel like the obvious answer is
Buddha. I can see Buddha in jeans. That's not that weird to me.
I feel like the obvious one is Jesus. Like if you walked into a Catholic church and they had the crucifix and Jesus was wearing jeans, like that would you would.
No, it's like buddy. It's like buddy hand. Jesus. I can see like youth group electric guitar Jesus and like
he gets down off the cross and starts playing the drum set. Yeah,
I think like you know Vishnu in jeans or like you know. Canon in jeans or something like
Ganesh. Can we get Ganesh in some large jeans?
I think Joseph, if that was if he had jeans of many colors, would also be good.
Oh boy, I want those jeans. Sign me up for that.
Do you have anybody?
I just said Ganesh.
Listen, that's your pick.
Are you tuning me out? What is this, Apocrypha?
No, I didn't know. That was part of a different, that was part of a conversation. I didn't know if you had a separate pick.
You like elephants in jeans. I get it. It's cool.
Yeah.
To bring it back
like Babar's bad boy cousin.
To bring it back to El Shaddai, I think, you know, once you get into the first level of the game, it's very action forward. And you kind of realize it is a little bit of like fight enemies, run forward, you know, fight some more enemies, run a little bit, maybe a little exploration, but not too much early on. Right. And like, I think, you know, once you realize, oh, there's not so much story, there's not like NPCs to talk to, there's not like non-combat things to do. I think the game would have actually benefited from like them trying to have some storytelling in the levels themselves because there's not much, you know.
Yeah. It's a pretty cutscene heavy game.
Yeah. There are a lot of cutscenes. The cutscenes are fun, but like, yeah, that's the only place the story is really like, you know, doled out.
Yeah, you encounter if you look around for them, you can encounter the Freeman who will hand you a little note, and that little note will give you some background about what's happening in the game somewhere, depending on where you find them. A lot of the notes mention Ishtar, which I wanted to ask. So, you know, as an American who grew up in the 80s, of course, Ishtar to me is famously the worst movie ever made, even though I've never seen it, so I don't know if it's good or not. What is Ishtar in this context? Does anyone know?
Well, I mean, that's not a name from the Jewish lore that is primarily being pulled from, but it is, you know, a Near Eastern deity. I mean, Ishtar, the goddess of war and love, maybe both.
Okay.
So, I mean, I like why her in particular, I'm not 100% sure unless they're trying to intentionally draw a parallel. If you could look at Enoch and Ishtar theoretically both as similar types of, you could draw a parallel with Jesus with both of those. And so maybe that's intentional. I would have to think more about that, but like, I don't know. It's actually, it's a little strange to me. Why Ishtar and not someone else.
Okay.
When she does appear in the game, she's like a youth, like late in the game.
As I understand it, there's a character whose name is Nana, a little girl. You see her, she's riding Nephilim. Yep. And then when Enoch takes that long nap I mentioned, she grows up into an adult. And I don't know that she becomes Ishtar so much as she seems to channel Ishtar.
I think the idea is that Ishtar lost her bodily form and she was like trapped in like a twilight dimension until she's able to like possess the child's body, although now an adult. And right. I don't know if Nana is supposed to be a reference to Inanna, which would be another you know, a Mesopotamian goddess who would be fairly similar to Ishtar.
I think she is meant to be a reference to Inanna, and I do believe, like, you know, thinking back to all this time ago, that there were, you know, Sawaki did have plans to continue the story, and that Ishtar was going to become a main character in, like, a second or third game. And I think maybe in some of the cell phone games he's made, like, she has reappeared, or in the manga. I haven't kept up with it all. And definitely in the art books, there's more of her. But yeah, she was meant to be a larger character later in the narrative.
So we have the angels, the fallen angels, a.k.a. the Watchers, a.k.a. the Grigori, and the names we've all heard before so far are Azazel, Sariel, Ezekiel, Barakel, Armaros, Noel there, Arakiel, and Semizaya? I should not pronounce that.
I think it's Semyaza.
Semyaza, okay. Thank you very much. And the angels, these group, the seven, they're essentially your quest. Like, when the game starts, Lucifer tells Enoch that, hey, you need to go onto the earth and find all these seven fallen angels and take care of them, because if you don't do this, there's going to be a giant flood, and that's going to wipe out the people. So we want you to do sort of, I guess, you're the tip of the arrow, I guess, right? You're going in there ahead of everything else, and you're going to take care of this, and that way we don't have to wipe out all the earth. But you only encounter some of the angels during the game. Some of them you'll fight many, many times in a row, and the game has an unusual practice where it's like, you'll be in a level and an angel will just appear and you'll fight them. And win or lose, the game just keeps going. Indeed, the first time you fight an angel, you will probably lose because A, you don't know what you're doing, and B, you don't even have a weapon yet. So they will probably kick your ass, but it doesn't matter because the game keeps going anyway. So only until very late in the game in specific situations do you actually have to fight and defeat the angel. And in those cases, they will always turn into something else. It's like, oh, you beat my humanoid form? Well, check this out. And then they get all freaky, right? Very freaky. Some good monsters in this game.
Also, many of the angels, like the face character angels who you fight, are based on celebrities. Like, some of them are obvious, others are not as obvious. But, like, there was some point while I was working on this game where I found development documents where, like, literally, like, a picture of David Bowie was there next to Sariel. And it's like, aha. Like, it's not just me who sees this. So, yeah, like, some of them are more obvious than others. But I found that very intriguing and interesting and very Sawaki. Very, like, you know, pulled from pop culture, this mishmash of influences. Nothing to do with actual Book of Enoch at all, you know.
Well, Armaros clearly believes he is Michael Jackson.
Oh, Armaros is 1,000% Michael Jackson. Yes. Sawaki MJ was huge in Japan, and, like, Sawaki, yeah, it's...
Yeah, and,
like,
he recently deceased at that point as well. I mean, he passed in 2009, so probably during the course of this game at some point...
Right, yeah, it was very fresh.
They lost their hero.
And I believe, like, the female one, she's like, inspired by the Oracle from The Matrix, and the one old
Gloria...
guy...
Gloria, I forget her last name.
Yeah. But, yeah. And then the old guy is like something Marlon Brando, I think.
Oh, so Father Superman. Okay. Yeah, it's all connected.
It's all connected.
You don't see much of them, but the archangels do come up from time to time. Gabriel, Michael, Raphael, and Uriel. Gabriel, Michael, and Raphael all introduce your weapons, which we'll get to in a moment. But Uriel is actually kind of like your backup. Once you get to know Uriel, you can summon him, and he helps out in something called the Overboost, which we'll get into in the gameplay. But Uriel actually does come into the battle and help you if you summon him, and the other three just kind of talk to you sometimes. So, you know, moral support, really. Moral support. let's talk about what the actual gameplay is like, because as we described so far, there's a lot of backstory, but the actual game itself is fairly straightforward in that you have, you know, you've got Enoch, you've got Lucifer, you have your goal, you're told that these seven fallen angels have built themselves a tower, and somehow this tower is shielded from God's view. Like, God can't see in there, so God can't do anything in there, but Enoch can get in there, and once you're in there, you're exploring the tower and going higher and higher and higher and fighting these monsters and the angels, and eventually you reach the top. But the way this game looks, nothing here looks anything like any Earth that I've been to. And I've been on the Earth for quite a while now. I've never seen any part of the Earth that looks quite like this, which I think, as we've discussed already, it's very arresting and gripping as a visual, but also none of it really has any sort of, it's completely ungrounded. So at some point, if you're not 100% on board, you're probably going to feel like, okay, I'm now on another floating platform, running to another floating platform, except it's green this time instead of blue. You know, I could see both opinions in the world.
What's interesting about El Shaddai, it's incredibly surreal, yet not cohesive at all. Like every level is weird and strange and memorable, but like doesn't look anything like the thing you did before, really?
Yeah, each level of the tower is essentially its own planet, I would say.
Well, and I'll say development of this game also presented challenges because it was on a very strange abandoned engine called Gamebryo, which even at the time was not very well supported. You know, this was a while ago before Unreal Engine and Unity had become like, you know, de rigueur. But like, yeah, it was definitely a weird engine that presented challenges for the development team.
Yeah, and I mentioned earlier like how there's like kind of a lack of cohesion. Like you saying that it's like every level is its own planet, I think is accurate, because sometimes it's like you're fighting on Rainbow Road or in a nightclub, and then it's like, no, now you're on Big Mushrooms.
Now you're on the Final. Now you're doing the Final Fantasy VII bike sequence.
Yeah, yes. now you're a motorcycle, and now you're in a side scroller. And I think there's a lot of the one thing I will always give to this game is there's a lot of ambition to be interesting, which I would much rather have than a Call of Duty.
You can be a memorable near miss / failure is better than like a, you know, okay Me Too game that's just like everybody else, you know.
Yeah, I mean look, I am a noted Suda Goichi fan, so right. I love a game that's almost good.
Yeah, I think El Shaddai has grasshopper energy. Like, you know, it's quirky, and that's part of what drew me to it. Is like, I knew this was never going to be a 9 or 10 out of 10, but I was like, if this could be a really memorable weird 6.5, I'm on board.
Well, we'll get to the scores later. For now, let's talk about the actual gameplay, because as we alluded to, it's combat, but it's also very simplified compared to other games like this.
Well, it's rock, paper, scissors, and that was part of the idea of Kimura, and let's make it Pokemon. Let's make it rock, paper, scissors. Yeah.
But from a button standpoint, it is extremely simple in that you have a jump button, you could double jump. There is only one attack button. There's only one attack button, and it's basically you can sort of time it, you can hold it down and charge an attack, you can combine the attack button with some of the other buttons, but basically there is one attack button, so you don't have to worry about lights and heavies and such. It's just, there's one attack button, really. You've got a block button. Yes, you can parry if you block at just the right time. I cannot do that. The left L1 or the left bumper is the purify button. The way this game works is that the weapons over time will degrade, and they can be broken if you get your ass kicked. But you can, at any time, stop and purify your weapon and basically repair it. But this does take a second or two, so you don't want to do this in the middle of combat, or at least not when you're next to somebody, because they'll smack you in the face and you'll be interrupted. You can also steal weapons from enemies, which happens a lot. A lot of enemies will attack you. Many times you'll be cornered by multiple enemies with different weapons, and that's your opportunity to sort of change. Like, oh, well, I have this one, but if I beat this guy down a little bit, I can take his weapon, and then I'll change to that one and use that one around. And sometimes you just find the weapons sitting around, especially during boss battles. They'll just sort of drop the weapons into the arena. It's like, okay, you want to change weapons? Go ahead. Because all the weapons have sort of a hierarchy, and if you're using the wrong one, it can be very difficult. In fact, late in the game, the wrong weapon will literally do nothing. You will basically bounce off your enemy. It's like, okay, well, you need to change weapons because this one won't work anymore.
And combat kind of happens in an instant. It's not like it happens just like while you're walking around. It like kind of stops and like combat starts. It's like almost like an RPG that way. Yeah.
A little bit. Yeah. The enemies sort of pounce, sort of surprise attack you, and you cannot move on until you beat all the enemies who are basically teleporting in usually one at a time. You're very seldom facing more than I would say
three
enemies at once. Like that's rare. It's usually one or two.
And I'll say, you know, combat against three enemies does require a lot of, you know, pinpoint, you know, dodging and, you know, careful consideration. You can't just button mash. That's one thing about El Shaddai. Like, you do kind of have to pay attention. It's not as easy. Like, as much as they wanted it to be accessible, like, there's a point at which it gets a little hard, you know? Yeah.
It can get tricky, absolutely. And you definitely get surrounded and you can get comboed. It can happen. But the game is generous in the fact that there's not a live system, but if you get knocked out, you can mash buttons and get back up. And there's no real indication of how many times you can do that. Indeed, this game has no HUD whatsoever. There's no heads-up display at all when you're playing the game.
Which was pretty avant-garde at that point for an action game. Yeah.
You're allowed to turn it on if you beat the game. You can basically turn it on after you beat the game to play it like a more traditional title. But when you first play the game, there is no information on screen at all. I think if you pause the game, it will show you your boost level, but that's it. Otherwise, you have nothing to work with as far as, you know, health or lives. The only real indication in that department is Enoch's armor. As you get beat up, his armor will break off. The blue jeans stay on. The blue jeans never come off. But he can get beat down to the point where he has no armor on whatsoever. And he's just a shirtless man in jeans.
The jeans stay on.
Absolutely. So there are basically three weapons in the game.
I think he should get stronger when he's only in his jeans.
That would be fair. There are basically three weapons, and as we say, they all have a sort of a rock, paper, scissors hierarchy. You've got the main one, which is the arc. It's basically a big blade. It's probably arch, right? A-R-C-H, arch. And
it only occurred to me, like, going back to it for this, that it's an arch, both because of its shape and also because archangels.
Yeah, probably.
Right?
Yeah. Probably,
I would think so, yes.
took me 3 years to get that.
But it looks like a bow, but you're hitting people with it like a sword.
Yeah. It's pretty cool as weapons go. It's definitely it's more distinct than the other two, I would say. It's good for slashing. When you have the arch equipped, you can slowly descend while falling, so it's really good to have during the platform sections. The gale, which is basically a little set of paper airplanes that fly next to you, those are for shooting people. So they're really good at long-range attacks, and they're really good against the enemies that try to run away from you, which there are some of those.
And don't they home
really hit? Doesn't really hit that hard.
I thought they kind of had homing abilities, but they're very weak. Yeah, right. Like,
yeah, like when if you're facing someone and you shoot at them, it will basically head for them. But if they're moving very fast, it will not like pursue them like a, you know, it's not like a heat-seeking missile or anything. But you can quickly overwhelm enemies who aren't that fast. Like in a big boss battle, if you want to play keep away, you can hang out over here and pepper the boss with, you know, the little shots. And then there's the veil, which is basically a big-ass shield, and it is a shield in that if you block, it enhances your defense, and it's very slow, but it also hits very hard, and most of the boss battles, I would say it's a good idea to have the veil, because it does the most damage in the shortest amount of hits, and it can help you defend against big attacks. So veil is usually the way to go against bosses, but not always. Not always.
I'll say, as a third weapon, it's a little anticlimactic, because it's more defensive, you know, it's not as, like, showy, really. Mm-hmm. Yeah. No.
But really, if you think about it, it truly is a rock, paper, scissors, because Vale is the rock and Arch is the scissors and Gale is the paper. Like they look like paper airplanes. So I think it really is a literal rock, paper, scissors happening. There's also Overboost, which you learn pretty late in the game. And that's, again, tied to a meter you cannot see. But if you trigger the Overboost, you go into sort of a frenzy mode. Your attacks do more damage. You'll refresh your health. You can summon Uriel to do kind of crazy big attacks with you. It's really important for a late boss battle. And I actually had to look it up again because I forgot how it worked. I was stuck on a late boss. Like, oh, my attacks are not doing any damage here. What am I supposed to do? And I looked it up. It's like, oh, I have to push these buttons, which I haven't pressed. Okay. But yeah, as a game, it is relatively linear. You're basically running down, even whether it's 3D or 2D, you're generally heading down one single path. There are some branches you can take. There is exploration to be found if you want to maybe meet more Freeman. Or there are some weird places where you sort of go into this sort of like void, and then you're in a different place where the darkness is coming up from the bottom, and you need basically very quickly escape the darkness, or if it catches you, you're dead. But in those zones, you can recover the bones of Ishtar. Now, an expert player out there probably found all the bones of Ishtar and knows what that happens. I am not an expert player. Whenever I found myself in those places, I just ran away from the darkness as fast as I possibly could because I didn't want to die. But that's a little thing you can do when you're not pursuing the main story if you're good at looking around. Because there's a lot of things like that. So little bits of lore here and there, more challenges. I don't know if it unlocks something. I honestly do not know because I couldn't find them.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember if I ever did all of those or not. I think the reward isn't that great, if I recall correctly. But yeah, there are some little things peppered throughout. But it's funny, thinking back on this game, I always thought that the second level was overall the best, like, paced, and in terms of exploration and combat and visuals. Like, yeah, I think as the game goes on, like, it becomes a little more, like, you know, random into what you're doing. Like, you know, like the bike level, the 2D level. I mean, it's there's not a lot of, you know, coherence and consistency through the second half of the game. Whereas the first two levels are pretty much like what you would kind of expect from a 3D action platformer combat game.
One thing worth mentioning right at the top is that the right stick doesn't really do anything. You cannot move the camera. And while I'm sure this was deliberate from the developers, what this also means is that when you're in certain positions and you have to jump around, you can't move the camera, and you might get angry at that because you can't properly picture, you know, you can't probably move the camera, so you don't feel like you have the right view of where you're jumping from, where you're jumping to. That definitely pissed me off a couple times. But in general, the game is good as all the saving, and if you fall down, you usually go right back to where you were. This is not a lot, it's not very punishing in that respect. It's very much like, oh, you missed, we'll just try it again.
There are a lot of bottomless pits, which you wouldn't necessarily expect in a modern game, but even a game back then is like, that's a lot of bottomless pits.
Yeah, things just floating over nowhere, and things that will bounce you down, again, it's all a surreal landscape, so why not, I guess? But there were definitely a couple times where it's like, I'm literally jumping where I cannot see where I'm jumping to. This is, I wish I could see where I'm going. Just let me move the stick here. So, Shane, do you have any idea how long El Shaddai was in development? I'm curious.
I would say about 2 years, maybe a little more.
Yeah.
Because when I came on board, it had already been in development for probably at least a year. And I think it launched about a year after I came on board. And that, yeah, as I said, like, there were plans initially for it to be longer. And then I was kind of rescoped and made, you know, subtractive design. Because, you know, the guys in charge of the company were very big fans of Team Eco, and like the whole idea of like less is more, and like let's pare it down and just do what we, you know, just do the core product here. So I think it got kind of pared down from one point, and it was the first title from Ignition to ship.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you know, because of like the pedigree of the people involved in Japan, a lot of them had come from other companies. You know, some people on the publishing side that come from Square Enix and stuff, like, so, like, you know, as it was like getting promoted in Japan, it actually had a lot of excitement, and, you know, this was, you know, a long time ago, 15 years ago, like the mimetic nature of its marketing, as we'll probably get into, was like a big deal, you know? So, like, yeah, it definitely, like, you know, when I saw it about a year out, I could see the potential in this. Like I was like, even if the gameplay isn't DMC, like the aesthetic and like approach to it was interesting and unique. And it felt like kind of a grasshopper way, something that like could be a cool, weird, interesting action title for Japan that had a chance in Japan, maybe less so in the West, just based on how weird it was. But yeah.
Yeah, I would say the big moment for El Shaddai was when a trailer, I don't know if it was E3 or it was maybe before E3, but definitely early 2010 is when the first trailer got out there. And that took the internet by storm, because basically what happens to the trailer is you've got Enoch, and he's wearing this big suit of armor, and he's made Lucifel. And they have a quick conversation where Lucifel says, "Hey, are you sure you've got enough armor?" Which in Japanese is "Sonna sobi wa daijoubu ka?" And Enoch responds like, "Oh yeah, it's fine. Don't worry about me. Daijoubu da. Mondai nai." And then he goes down to the earth and immediately gets his ass kicked. Just totally beat down. Like, destroyed. then the game, the trailer sort of rewinds and you see it again and the same conversation happens. But this time Enoch turns to Lutzfell and he's like, Ichibani ni wa tonomu, which is like, basically, give me the best you got. Give me what you, whatever you got. Give me the best one you got. And that's when he gets the magic white armor. And that's how the game starts. And those three lines in particular were huge in Japan. They became instant meme fodder, you know, videos, still images, whatever you want. It was everywhere. I can tell you here in Osaka, I used to go shopping at a game store called A2. I think it's since been bought out and it's part of the Suguraya chain, but A2 used to be its own shop. And I remember going to A2 one day and in the coin tray, if you're ever shopping in Japan at a store, you basically put your money in a tray for the staff and they'll put your change in the tray and the receipt. Like, that's how it works. You don't usually hand your money to the staff. Their coin tray was a giant still of Enoch saying, Daidobuja, mondaina. Wow. Like, this meme escaped the internet containment. It was in the real world.
Yeah.
And that, it was just massive.
And they also had, you know, they made tie-ups with, again, like, the jeans are with this cool Japanese company called Edwin Jeans that's still around that is, like, a kind of a high-end boutique jeans manufacturer. And, like, the, you know, those are produced to come out, like, around when the game came out. Or, like, and the toys were with Bandai. And the soundtrack was on Digicube from Square Enix. So, like, for what was ostensibly an indie game, really. I mean, you know, it had a budget behind it, but not, like, it wasn't a known publisher, it wasn't a known entity. For a game that came out of nowhere, it kind of like, did land, like, weirdly fully formed as an IP in Japan.
What was the, like, why jeans? Like, at what point? Because that seems, if you're coming to it from, you know, the Book of Enoch perspective, that seems like the weirdest thing in the entire game. Because I've already heard of all the Nephilim and angels.
Yeah, I think it actually is the weirdest thing in the game. Like, if I think about it, like, it really is.
Where did the genes come from?
I mean, all I can say is that, like, Takehisa Sawaki is a really stylish, quirky, introverted guy in a very, like, Tetsuya Nomura kind of way, right? Like, when you meet him, he, like, strikes a figure and he's dressed really, really interesting, weird couture clothes and, like, yeah, I think he just has a fashion-forward mindset, and that was a part that he really wanted to put in the game. And I think, secretly, it was the secret sauce. Like, if you think about El Shaddai in 2026, you probably are thinking about the jeans. I don't know, right? Like,
in a way, I think about the jeans.
Yeah, I think about it. If this game is 15 years ago, the fact that, like, it dealt with memes and fashion and, like, things outside the game, you know, but are kind of more memorable than the game itself is, yeah, it's, in a way, it's forward-thinking to the culture we live in now.
Yeah, to me, like, the jeans are the biggest thing about the game. Like, it's very much like, oh yeah, it's kind of inspired by the Book of Enoch, but they gave him jeans. Like, I would mention that before anything else about the game.
No shirt, no shirt, no shoes, armor made out of iPods, jeans.
Well, and the jeans are amazing. Like, in the inside of the jeans, there's, like, stitching of, like, the language, you know, like, whatever the, like, there's, like, image, there's, like, all kind of weird, like, details in the jeans that are, like, from the game, too.
I want the jeans so bad.
Yeah, I should have, I wish I'd
missed them. Although, now, knowing that, like, the second you said you had a plush Nephilim, I was like, that's the new thing I need.
The plush Nephilim is huge. It's huge. I mean, it's in my closet. I could go get it. Yeah, the plush Nephilim is, like, ridiculous, actually. Yeah, that's what you need.
Amazing.
But yeah, the jeans were a big part of everything. Indeed, I remember. So at TGS 2010, Ignition had their own booth, and essentially the entire booth was El Shaddai. And all the booth attendants were ladies wearing jeans and I think little crop tops. I believe they even had a little temporary tattoo on their.
We did have crop tops. I believe my CEO, he made sure to cast the entire booth. So, yeah.
Yeah. As well, I mean, I say the style of the time, it's still pretty much the style of TGS. They still do a lot of you know, quote unquote, booth babes, but still, they were uniquely sort of unified in that case, with that they all had the same outfit on, and it was very much a call to Enoch's outfit in the game, not Lucifer. They were definitely dressed as Enoch.
And it was a big setup. Did they have any of the iPod armor?
I think if we. I don't know if I have any pictures. Again, it's that's the problem. It's TGS 2010, so you have to. It's hard to find pictures of that because most English language websites have basically stopped existing from that point. And if you find a Japanese website from TGS 2010, any pictures they have are about this big. Listeners, I'm putting my fingers very close together because the Japanese internet has traditionally been very bad about sharing images because of, I don't know, I guess they're worried about offending someone, I think, or interfering with someone's rights. So, like, most pictures on the internet in Japan are very small or just not even there. Like, look at Japanese Wikipedia. That's my case and all my evidence. Look at Japanese Wikipedia. Look at how few pictures are on Japanese Wikipedia. It is ridiculous.
I was hoping to search through my old digital camera archives to find the photos I took of the El Shaddai Cafe. There was a pop-up cafe around the launch that I attended. And as an aside, I was excited to go because, you know, I worked on the game. I loved El Shaddai. And, like, I went with some coworkers and we went in there and we realized – as we're enjoying our El Shaddai themed food and drinks, that like it was probably 80 or 90% women. And this is in Tokyo. It was mostly, it was almost all women in the El Shaddai cafe. It was like very few men. And I was like, oh, this is interesting. This is an interesting clientele. That this game definitely appeals to like fans of Bishonen. And yeah, I think like that was the core contingency of El Shaddai fans in Tokyo.
I don't have my fingers on the pulse of the fandom, but I would imagine that when this game came out and when it was presenting these two very beautiful men at the center of things, you know, Enoch and Lucifer are both beautiful in their own way, I would assume a lot of women, the Fujoshi, if you will, got out their pens and pencils or their keyboards and started writing about how these two men love to kiss each other. That's my theory. Now, do I know that happened?
And I'll say,
I don't know.
The relationship between the characters does kind of, like, yeah, they have this imbalance of power. And yeah, I think the game kind of like does lead to that.
I mean, in this very first trailer, one man asks the other man to dress him. I just feel like that implies an intimacy that you don't normally see in action heroes.
I think what you're missing is that, and Benito, I know that you can speak to this from experience as well. Ladies love Enochian literature.
Oh.
They do.
Women love Apocrypha.
Yeah. They do. They're like, give me that sweet Merkava mysticism. I'd explore the chariot throne of God.
Maybe if God's Little Helper was wearing sexy designer jeans.
I'm every time I bring up Enoch and the wheels within wheels, I'm always like, well, that's Isaiah, but you know what I mean. Every time I bring up Enoch, I'm like, hey, ladies, I'm married. I'm a married man. But like Enoch, I ain't dead.
Let's talk 2011 and let's talk about when the game actually comes out. So it comes out first in Japan in April of 2011. Famitsu gives it 34 out of 40, which I would say is pretty good. It sells about 80,000 copies across the PlayStation and Xbox platforms. I have a quote from one Shane Bettenhausen in March who says, "This is a piece of art, really." And I agree with you, Shane. It is a piece of art.
Holds up. Piece of art. More than
the
a game you want to play.
International versions start to arrive in August. I don't know. I found some websites saying July, but I was there in New York in August, and I remember it coming out in August.
It was delayed to August. Yeah,
yes.
There was a slight delay due to production issues.
Right. And I remember this very well because I was down in Chinatown, and I found a copy of the game already on store shelves ahead of the so-called street date. Like, well, I'm buying this, of course.
Flying it.
Yeah. And then later that night, Shane, you and I met up with John Ricciardi, who was in New York for some reason, and Shuichi Aizawa, I think, and we were all just in a hotel lobby somewhere, having a couple drinks and enjoying the evening, and just, you know, we kind of had a little impromptu launch party.
That did happen, yes. Wow.
I very much enjoyed, and that's when, I think it was you who told me about the, oh my god, the Halal Guys, the
yes,
food cart.
The Halal Guys food cart.
The Halal Guys food cart near MoMA in New York City, and that like I went there the very next day, and I was like, oh boy, this really is good.
Okay, now you're making me sad, Diamond, because the Halal Guys expanded across America, and like about 2 years ago, here in my little town in California, we had a Halal Guys, and then about 6 months ago, it closed. I couldn't believe it. I'm not, RIP, hello guys out here.
I'm sorry. They're still in New York. I know they're still out there.
Yeah.
So, what happened when the game came to America, or the English-speaking world, I should say? I would say most critics responded positively. I have some quotes here. So, Jose Otero, for 1UP, we all know Jose. Jose gave it a B and said, I enjoyed my adventure from the beginning to end, but I'm still wondering what really happened at certain parts of the story. The late Andrew Fitch for EGM, he gave it a 7, and he said, I'd rather play 100 El Shaddais than the latest paint-by-numbers action game formed in a committee.
Man of wisdom.
Very true. Very
yes.
true. Like, again, so far, I fully agree.
Well, and I'll say, just, you know, full cards on the table here. Leading into the review cycle of El Shaddai, I remember potentially there are companies that publishers pay lots of money to make mock reviews for you and tell you what scores you're going to get for your game. That's the thing that people do.
Yes.
And say, theoretically, hypothetically, that had happened. And I'm like, well, that may be true, but I think we can get 10 points better than that. And we did. And, like, you know, having been on both all the sides of game journalism and publishing, there is something that can be said about, like, yeah, there are things you can do in marketing and PR to, like, you know, influence the scores a bit. So I do believe the El Shaddai's Metascore may be a little bit slightly enhanced.
Well, at that point, Shane, because this is relevant to the conversation, I mean, you left 1UP not that long before this, right? You left in what, 2008, 2009?
2009. So,
Yeah.
So I was there from, I had been at Ignition about a year and a half by the time this came out. Yeah.
So, you know, Jose Otero and Andrew Fitch, like, these are your coworkers and friends, right? Like, this is fair to say.
One could say.
Yeah. So I'm not saying you called them on the phone like, hey, Jose, be sure to give this at least a B, but I'm just saying, Jose played that game knowing full well your name was in the credits.
Maybe I sent them a copy of the Bible with it. Who knows, right? Like, it's possible. Here's the Lost Testament of the Latter-day Saints. Here's some crazy shit.
I do wonder if anyone, like, if this brought anyone to any religious conclusions.
I wonder if we got, like, you know, like, yeah, they were converted by El Shaddai Ascension of the Metatron. They're like, I'm going to go get baptized. Maybe.
I do want to highlight Kezia McDonald for Eurogamer. She gave it a 9 out of 10, and she says, El Shaddai Ascension of the Metatron is the maddest and most beautiful thing I have played since I don't even know. And she continues, there's no way to describe El Shaddai's visual style without sounding like an amateur poet, but the screenshots don't lie.
She gets it.
And we even have a quote from me. I wrote an import review for Play Magazine, which I don't know if that exists anymore, but you can find the review online. I gave it a 77% out of 100, and the line I wrote, which was then edited into this, says, we went in expecting a feast for the eyes, and in this respect, El Shaddai is nothing less than a royal banquet.
I will say, later, after that review happened, I later may have negotiated a exclusive cover story with Play Magazine for Muramasa the Demon Blade after that.
Okay.
Such a good review.
That didn't involve me, but okay.
No. But because you guys were so kind, El Shaddai.
Unfortunately, while this was happening and the game's coming out, Ignition Tokyo is shutting down. And Ignition in general seems to be sort of withdrawing from the games in general, because Ignition had multiple studios and multiple locations, and they all shut down between 2010 and 2012. And according to Takeyasu in a Famitsu interview just a couple years ago, he says, this was decided before El Shaddai shipped and had nothing to do with sales figures. With all the memes and the studio closing after release, rumors that El Shaddai is a bad game started to spread. So, as it turns out, El Shaddai Ascension of the Metatron is the only game to actually have the Ignition Tokyo name on the box.
This is true. And I get a little more transparency. Like, when I first went there, I knew that they had 3 games in production, and also that they were funding the development of Dragon's Crown with Vanillaware. So between El Shaddai and Dragon's Crown, those are the two things that I was really excited about. Because to be honest, the titles being developed in UK, that one was a known quantity called War Devil, which was made by Toby Gard, a Tomb Raider designer. This game never came out. It was on the cover of Edge, however. And another game being developed in the US by the departed ex-id person Paul Steed. This game was called Reich. It was a first-person shooter where you were a Nazi.
Oh,
those two games never came out and weren't looking so great.
Why?
Why did something happen?
Those games
did
were
the Nazis
south.
Get canceled?
Those games were going south, and it became like, well, we got to get El Shaddai out the door because this game is worth. You know, the world needs to see El Shaddai, and we need to make sure Dragon's Crown has a home. So, like, towards the end, it was like a get El Shaddai out. We're proud of this. But yeah, unfortunately, the studio, I think at this point also, like, the idea of Disney buying our parent company was already a thing, too. So, yeah, it was kind of like winding up quickly.
Well, again, in the same interview with Famitsu, Takeuchi talked about the production problems and how it impacted the staking of the game and the storytelling. Because he said, like, during production, he found out there were basically only two options on the table. They could cancel the game, or they could release it in whatever state it was in. And he the quote from him is, a game has zero value unless it's actually released. So they felt the best strategy was get it out the door, even if that means compromising some of the story ideas, which in his opinion, he describes the story as half finished or ending abruptly. Which I can see, because when if you beat the game, it does kind of come to a quick end, and you're like, well, what about all this stuff? So I get it. And I get, you know, while you're making that game, you know, facing those two choices, I would say, yeah, just get it out there. You don't want to cancel it after all this.
Yeah,
that's
accurate. He definitely had design documents for a lot more stuff that didn't make it into this game. And I agree, like, this game exists. We're talking about 15 years later, whereas, like, and I'll say this, you know, working on Ignition was my first experience working on the other side of, you know, publishing and development. And, like, seeing not just those two games I mentioned, but several other games be in development that never got announced, that got canceled. And, you know, in the many years since then, me working in the gaming industry, like, the number of projects that, like, get halfway done or completely finished and get thrown in the garbage can. And it happens in film too. Remember, like, the Batgirl movie? Like,
yep.
Like, these things, like tons of people will spend years of their life and tens of millions of dollars, and, like, you have nothing to show for it, and no one will ever know about it. It's very sad. So at least El Shaddai, in all of its fucked upness, like, hey, at least we can still talk about it all these years later.
And play it, indeed.
And play it.
Yeah, I experienced that myself this very year.
Oh, I'm sorry.
He sure did.
That sucks. Yeah.
So, post-Ignition closure, as we talked about earlier, Sawaki Takeyasu did indeed acquire the rights to El Shaddai, so he still has them today, and he forms a new company called Crim, C-R-I-M, Crim, and whenever you see anything El Shaddai these days, it's usually the company that's attached to it. I have this line from an interview, I don't know if he was kidding, because it's in text, but according to Sawaki Takeyasu, I received a heavenly decree. God says, continue making El Shaddai.
Wow, okay. He's been touched.
He said that. It's on the record.
I mean, you know, that's the latest in a long line of Enochian literature for which that was the inspiration.
And Diamond, you know, in Japan, many Japanese people, like, they don't consider, you know, monotheism. They don't consider, like, oh, only one, I can only adhere to one religion. They might check six boxes on a survey. Like, oh, I'm into all this stuff.
That's true. In the original Japanese, he just says kami, but as you know, Japanese does not really deal in plurals, so we don't know what kami that was. Could have been any kami. Could have been the kami at the shrine next door, you know?
Could have been dende.
Yeah. As good a kami as any. But yeah, there are, if you look for it, there are tons of El Shaddai books and manga and all sorts of materials, mostly entirely in Japanese, so unless you read Japanese, it's not going to do much for you, but it's all out there. And there have been periodic other games, although most of them were very small and some of them don't exist anymore. For example, El Shaddai Social Battle, a 2012 GREE release, if you know GREE, the Japanese mobile gaming company. That was a free-to-play game, but it shut down within a few months, so just gone. You've got El Shaddai Coin and Epic, a 2013 game for smartphones. I think this still exists, but it is just a virtual coin pusher, so I guess you just push the coins on the screen and Enoch and Lucifer talk to you. That's probably all there is.
Give your money to Jesus.
Digital tithing.
Prototype Jesus.
We also have the Shinwa Koso RPG, The Lost Child, 2017, multiple platform, PS4, Vita, and Switch.
Enoch as a guest character.
Yep, Enoch and Lucifer are in the game, even though it's a dungeon crawler, so it's a very different game than El Shaddai, but it is of that world. It has since been digitally delisted because of some sort of publishing issue, but as I said, it's on those three platforms, which all of which shipped a physical cartridge. So if you still want to play those games, I guess go to eBay and you'll find a cartridge. Of course, the big move, 2021, the 10th anniversary, they have the El Shaddai Ascension Metatron Remaster, HD Remaster. It is multi-platform. It is on Steam. I think it's on Switch now. I don't know. Is it on the PlayStation, Shane Bennethousand?
Not yet.
No. Not yet. Okay. But Steam and Switch, that's pretty good. Pretty good, well, pretty accessible.
And I was really happy to see that Steam version come out, because back in the day, we had a PC version that never came out. That was the best version.
That's a bummer.
Yeah.
But certainly the Steam version, I bought it. I replayed it for the recording of this podcast. It runs beautifully. I had a couple crashes, but it really was not a big deal. Very pleased by my experience revisiting El Shaddai. But yeah, I'm glad it's on consoles, at least in Switch version. Hopefully it comes to more consoles or Switch 2 or whatever.
Do you think we could get Enoch in Smash?
maybe as an assist, but I wouldn't think as a playable character.
At the very least, I'd love to see some Enoch and Lucifer gear for the Miis, you know? That'd be good. Little Mii outfits? Sure.
See, I feel like they would make more sense in, like, Final Fantasy world. Like, I always felt like both Lucifer and Enoch could make it into something Nomura did. Like, if he redesigned them, I'd be very into that, personally.
Even more recently than that, though, we have last year's mythical concept Starknaught, that Takasu describes as a 3D Vampire Survivors, and he literally says, the moment I saw Vampire Survivors, I thought, I want to make this in 3D. So I can only assume that somehow played a role in him getting the job at Punkle, because obviously he met the Italian man who runs Punkle. I forget his name, but they're clearly working together now, so good for him. And even this year, this very, very year, 2026, there is El Shaddai 09 Reversi, which is a, you know, Reversi Othello game for smartphones, with, I guess, Enoch and Lucifer is white and black. I didn't play it. I'm sorry.
I'm just happy that Othello is still a thing, like, you know, 40, 50 years later. Amazing.
Hey, you know, it's like the box says, you know, takes a moment to learn, but a lifetime to master.
But 14,000 years to master.
Or maybe tomorrow.
Enoch Othello, that's the world needs.
But yes, let's talk future or the past or whatever. We don't know what time goes this way. So obviously, Sawada Takeyasu really believes in and is committed at this point to the world of El Shaddai. He told that interview, he said, I have actually written many proposals for a sequel to El Shaddai, but no one has given him the green light for that. And he laughed, which I'm assuming was one of those painful laughs, like, So obviously, if someone gives him money, I think he would clearly make another game, as many games as he could possibly make, given some funds. The interview at the end, they asked him, like, what's your message to fans who are interested in El Shaddai? And he said the line. He said, "Daijoubu da, mondai nai. Ichiban ii kaikata o tanomu," which, like, basically, you know, it's fine, no problem. Buy it the best way you can. So he on knows brand. His audience.
He's on brand. Yeah. And, like, I'm happy because I will say, like, the core of El Shaddai really to me is his art. Like, like, I think he's a spectacular artist. Like, I was looking through my art books earlier. The art's beautiful. It's, you know, it's very memorable and unique. And, like, yeah, if it wasn't for his hand-drawn art, I think there wouldn't be El Shaddai.
I have El Shaddai line stamps. So that's all his art and quotes like that stuff. So I know my wife and my children have no idea why I send them, you know, these people saying "Daijoubu da, mondai nai" so much. But I know, and that's what's important.
There's a lot left in the books of Enoch to be explored in a physical, literal sense. Where's the warehouses full of snow?
There's so many types of jeans that could be in the game. What if the second one he had JNCOs?
and he could, like, they could, like, that's how he does slow fall.
Yeah, no fall damage so when he's wearing when he's wearing the holy JNCOs. Yeah.
Like, you know, if I was a billionaire, I would go to Sawaki and be like, hey, let's do Moral Shaddai, but like, let's make a different genre, like an RPG or something. Cause I think, you know, like if it was more of like a turn-based RPG or something, I think it would have a greater appeal.
I think you're right. Like, I think the, maybe because you mentioned that aesthetically it seems to fit in with a modern Final Fantasy. And so I feel like maybe that's why I instantly think like, oh, that's the move. Like, right. That's so,
or even
right.
Like a like a Shin Megami Tensei, you know, the whole, like, you're like, you know, the way that series has like mixed together demonology of all these different pantheons, like, but yeah, like, you know, Christian apocrypha, weird, abstract, turn-based, sexy RPG. I think there could be something there.
I mean, I will say Persona 5 is my favorite game in which Enoch appears.
Yeah, I was going to say you've opened a whole can of Chris Worms by saying Persona 5.
Could we have Enoch from Persona 5? Could we ship him with Enoch from El Shaddai? That's the question.
Please see our video episode where I make Benito guess.
We already did this.
I made Benito guess what biblical figures were represented by their designs from Persona. So...
I love it. I gotta see this now. Please send me those links. I'll put them in the show notes. We're here. It's 2026. What are our El Shaddai opinions? I feel like I've been pretty transparent. I'm excited about this game. I just played it again. I had a thrilling time with it. I don't think I would host this episode if I didn't have a passion for this game. It caught me by surprise before it even came out. I played it upon release. I've since played it again. I am a big fan. But Chris, Benito, you have obviously a lot of other opinions about this. What would you say about El Shaddai? Go ahead. It's okay. Let it out.
I mean, I think the thing is, I think we would all agree about the details.
Yes?
It's just, for me, those shortcomings outweigh what's fun about it.
But is it a full, like, the critic, it stinks? Or is it like, oh, there's things that are memorable and good about this, but overall, it's not a fun time? Like,
no, I certainly do not regret playing it. And I think it is, again, at the very least, it's interesting. And I will always pop for, like, a video game that can be interesting and weird and memorable. Like,
an ambitious failure. Yeah.
Yeah, I'll be thinking about it until the day I die. You know, I'll be thinking about Enoch running around in those jeans. Like,
yeah.
Like, I've read all four books of Enoch and discussed them at length on the show, and in my head, that dude's wearing jeans.
Oh, see, that's a victory, yeah. Like,
yeah, like, so, like, yeah. I certainly don't, I don't think it's a, you know, bottom of the barrel, you know, absolutely irredeemable experience. I just, it's not what I'm looking for in my video game diet. For reasons that I think we all agree on, like, you know, the sort of lack of cohesion, the obscured storytelling. I do think it is weird to play a game and be like, but where's all the Bible stuff? Because that stuff, I think, is actually weirder and more interesting than a lot of what makes it in the game.
Yeah, I mean, look, I'm in favor of there being more. I'd love to see what happens next. And especially if there were... You know, there weren't restrictions. Like, where does this go when the leash is off? I'd be very interested. I won't play it because I don't play video games, but someone would. Chris, I would make Chris do it. But I'm very interested in it existing in the world.
You can just watch video games now. Yeah, go on Twitter.
I do watch. That's how I know about this game. I watched some other person play it for 6 hours on YouTube.
It took me thinking about it today to be like, why didn't, because I wasn't familiar with this game at all until after we started doing the podcast. And I'm like, how did I completely miss this when it came out? And I'd never had a PS3. Like, I was on the Xbox that generation. So I was just simply not paying attention.
Well, and all these years later, my thoughts haven't changed too much. I was always a fan, but I always knew what it was. And, like, I always thought it had the potential to be a cult classic, which I think is what it's kind of become. You know, cult classic, question mark. Like, there are people who love it. There are people who don't know about it. But, like, you know, I think much like Deadly Premonition and, you know, a pickup title we signed, it's like, I knew these games weren't great, but they were quirky and fun and, like, kind of like their flaws made them interesting too. And they were unique takes of Western culture through a Japanese lens, which I find very interesting as a Japanophile. So yeah, I'm really proud to have worked on it. And like, I also, looking back to like on all the merchandise and like today listening to the soundtrack, like a lot of the things that like were outside of the game were really high quality actually. I think like the jeans, like if you ever get lucky enough to get a pair of the jeans are like really nice, you know, like the jeans are almost better than the game, but I'm so proud of the game. And I think that like, you know, anybody who's listening to this should definitely check the game out, at least watch it on YouTube or Steam. It's pretty cheap on Steam, I think, actually, or on Switch, you can get it. Like, yeah, it's like, it's fun and weird. And there's nothing else quite like it out there.
Yeah, I would, I you mentioning the, seeing a piece of Western culture like through the Japanese lens, like that's something again that I'm always super interested in, partly because like I've read a lot of comics about ninjas and samurai by white dudes from America, so I feel like it's only fair.
Right. Yeah, some of these designer jeans and cell phones when Japan does, you know, Western religion.
Yeah.
Well, actually, Shane, what you just said was really important to me because I want to know, is there anything we can recommend that is anything like El Shaddai? I don't know if there is.
It's tough because, you know, there's games that have combat that is slightly reminiscent of the combat in El Shaddai, but there's nothing that quite like looks or feels or imparts a story in the abstract way. Like, it's pretty singular, actually.
Right? Like, because one thing, like, what first comes to mind is that when you talk about this stuff with the angels and so on, I think back to Evangelion, which has sort of a very different view of angels and Earth and a lot of stuff. But Evangelion games are just so dry, you know, it's very straightforward usually.
I do think aesthetically, there is something between El Shaddai and Evangelion. That's what drew me to it as well. Like,
right.
Yeah, there's something there. But right, there's no, even if there was ever an Evangelion action, you know, platformer, maybe it would be kind of like El Shaddai, but that never happened.
But yeah, so. They're not really. Yeah, those games are usually not like that, unfortunately. So,
I mean, I do think that Bayonetta, which does do a lot of the weird, you know, angelology stuff.
That's true. That's true.
Of
that's
having, and you're right. And the way you progress through the levels, and
powers.
Yeah, Bayonetta is kind of a better El Shaddai in that way. You're right. It's like a much more tight, complicated, aesthetically, you know, detailed, cohesive, sexy. Yeah, that's probably the closest analog.
Listen, I am the Bayonetta liker.
Also, I was recently reminded that Bayonetta is in Ready Player One, and the fact that Steven Spielberg has Bayonetta in a movie is just, like, anathema to me. Like, can we take that out of the Bible? Like, come on. Like,
there's a lot of stuff that's in Ready Player One, but that does make me feel like if I ever meet Steven Spielberg, I can, you know, we've got one thing in common.
You're like, you both like a sexy librarian.
Who's 8 feet tall.
With giant heels.
Guns on her feet, so she can kick you in the face and shoot you in the face at the same time.
Diamond, does Nintendo own Bayonetta now? This is the question. I'm curious.
Nintendo has published Bayonetta 2 and 3,
Wasn't she in Smash Brothers to bring it back?
She is in Smash Brothers. Yeah,
she's in like, Smash.
Bayonetta allowed in. EDOC, not so much.
I don't know the rights issues, because, I mean, obviously, it's a Platinum game originally, but Platinum, the Bayonetta 1 was entirely Sega. And then these later games published by Nintendo, I don't know where that fits in the Platinum, Sega, Nintendo hierarchy. Mm. I know Platinum and Sega have a very rocky relationship. So, yeah. I don't know. I don't know what happens there.
My next question is, has anybody shipped Enoch and Bayonetta? My answer would probably be yes, I would think. But
yeah. I got to hit up 803 to find out.
I mean, you would assume at some point someone offered Bayonetta a pair of jeans because that way she could attack more. Like, she's holding back her power.
Yeah,
she's holding back her power to cover those areas. Right, you know,
her clothing is made of her hair. Correct.
Yes, exactly.
Okay. Yes.
Yeah. So if someone gave her the blue jeans, she could go all out, and at least she'd know for sure that her ass was well taken care of.
Bayonetta 5 will guest star Enoch as a playable character. We heard it here first.
We can only hope. We can only hope.
I'm ready for it. I'm here for that.
You'd be cheering, yes.
I'd buy that. Absolutely, I'd buy that. But for now, we're buying the end of this podcast because we've been here for a while, and this is a good chat as any. So thank you very much for joining us here at Retronauts. If you did not pay money for this episode, thank you very much for listening. You should know, however, that Retronauts is a fan-supported program, so please go to patreon.com/retronauts for $3 a month. You get all our episodes 1 week early. For $5 a month, you get lots of bonus stuff, extra episodes, extra columns from me, and I read you the columns, a monthly community podcast only for our listeners, Discord access, all these things at $5, and even higher levels where you can tell us what you want to be on the show, or you can be on the show. It's all there, patreon.com/retronauts. Let's go around to my guests. Let's start with Shane. Shane, what do you want the internet to know about you, if anything?
Well, that being a Retronauts Patreon supporter is awesome, and your columns are fantastic, and everyone should do it. And you can follow me on the Blue Sky. Search for my name. I don't know what my Blue Sky is. Shane Bettenhausen.
Spelled just like it sounds. How about you, Chris?
You can find me and everything that I do at the-isb.com. As alluded to earlier, I don't currently have a job. So if you'd like someone to write something for you, then by all means, get in touch. I can provide excellent references, and I know a lot about things, not necessarily in Bible.
Thank you. Benito?
All right. If you want to hear me and Chris talk about stuff, there's something like an archive of 120-ish episodes of ApocryPals. You can check those out. I also co-host the horror movie podcast Friends Till the End with some other people who are not currently on this podcast. I'm on Blue Sky, BenitoSereno.bsky.social. I'm on Patreon, patreon.com/BenitoSereno, where you can see things like my completely made up conspiracy theory that I thought of while I was in line at Raising Cane's the other day about how the current sitting president is technically still vulnerable to the curse of Tecumseh. If you don't know what that means, go to my Patreon. It's free. But also, you can find me monthly in comic book stores. I'm the writer on the books Blood and Thunder and Capes, both out from Image Comics and Skybound Entertainment. And those come out every month. So look for me there.
That's Capes, not Cakes.
Capes, yeah. C-A-P-E-S. It's an Invincible tie-in.
Okay.
It's like what superheroes wear, not what supervillains steal.
I've heard it's really good, actually. I'll have to check that out. Yeah.
Well, it's my second issue just came out last week. So, but I'll be on it for the foreseeable future. Robert Kirkman has made a public promise of at least 25 issues of the book. So,
good for him and good for you. Thank you. As for me, Diamond Fight, you can find me over the internet by looking for Fight Club, F-E-I-T, that's my last name, C-L-U-B, that's an English word, you know, put them together, look on social media, obviously, Blue Sky, Letterboxd, Patreon, Ko-Fi, anything you want there, look for Fight Club. It's usually me, except for occasional squatters. And yeah, on that note, I'm going to attempt to snap my fingers and end the podcast. Let's see if it works. Maybe Greg, you can help me out here. Good night.